Catoter animarie, orang in uye tui hone, o papu tuanu kue takatone, o te taiae afine ia tato, tihe maori ora. This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Today on the Green Desk, Mitchell talks to Saidef Duda Ozyurt, who is the leader of the Aotearoa Youth Delegation at the COP24 conference held in Poland in November last year. They discuss the aim of COP, what it's all about, New Zealand's stance, and the role the IPCC report played in the conference. Mitchell begins asking Saidef a bit about how she ended up at COP and the nuts and bolts of it all.
So my name is Saidef Duda Ozyurt. I'm 22 and I study environmental studies at Torrey University in Wellington. And I have been incredibly lucky to have gone to the United Nations climate change talks both last year and the year before that, so COP23 and COP24, with the Aotearoa Youth Leadership Institute, or ALI, who send young people overseas to international conferences. So COP for me, God, who cares about what it was like for me? COP itself, I think, is something that isn't understood enough by people of the general populace. And it really just is an acronym that means Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is a silly way of saying that the people in the United Nations, the parties, which is all but Palestine, got together and decided that climate change was an issue that needed to be worked on in 1992. Set up the convention, and every year they meet annually to make decisions about climate change with all the parties, and the parties just means the countries, and they're all focused on climate change. Whether their intentions are good or not is debatable. Not everyone has the same ultimate out goal, and there's obviously a lot of politics going on, which makes it an incredibly fraught space to be in. So at COP there's multiple worlds going on. There's like the negotiators who get together and they are negotiating on the technical aspects of whatever text they're working on. So since COP21 in Paris, that is the Paris Agreement, and it's negotiating all the aspects of that, like who pays what to climate adaptation funds and who's responsible for having the most mitigation or the highest mitigation target. Is it the developing countries? Is it the non-developed countries? And all the kind of arguments that come along with that. At the same time, you've got a lot of people from civil society who represent different interest groups, like young people, women, people with backgrounds such as Indigenous communities who are fighting to be listened to, and people from like communities that are people with disabilities who are still struggling to be listened to. But the point is that there's a lot of voices.
So just before, like, I'm quite interested in the Paris Agreement, but before we get to that part, talked about out goals. So what was New Zealand's sort of stance in it following the IPCC report, which kind of took aim at intensive farming and things like that?
So New Zealand is very pro-agriculture in what it does and in terms of what it advocates for in that part of the negotiations. It's very pro doing agriculture in the most sustainable and clean way, off the back of an argument that if there's not countries who are developed like New Zealand who are leading voices in agriculture, then other countries are going to do it in much more dirty and unsustainable ways. So therefore we have a responsibility to feed the world with dairy, and we will continue what we're doing but just refine the process so that it's more sustainable. That is obviously something that I and a lot of people don't agree with, because it's kind of like glorifying the problem. But in terms of agriculture, New Zealand has a very pro, we can make this more efficient and sustainable approach through doing things like genetically modifying ways that cows operate so that they don't release as much methane, and having soil that reduces runoff, and things that are kind of skirting around the issue, in my opinion. I think like the science shows us that agriculture is a huge, huge issue, and for New Zealand that's 48% of our emissions profile, and companies like Fonterra, that kind of supposedly the backbone of our economy, are huge emitters. Like Fonterra has a greater emissions profile along with the five other top dairy and meat companies internationally than Shell. So I think that goes a long way to say that agriculture is a massive emitter, especially for countries that rely on it so heavily like New Zealand. So in terms of agriculture, New Zealand's not doing fantastic, in my opinion. I think we really need to move away from relying on livestock agriculture and looking at other ways to grow food and to help people overseas with what we produce in a way that doesn't involve meat or dairy. And actually, 98% of what we make goes to China anyway. So it's a kind of, this whole thing about needing to feed the world is kind of moot when it comes down to the facts that you look at. Yeah, New Zealand was pushing that rhetoric of sustainable agriculture and being a leader and partner to our Pacific neighbours.
So just something you said at the beginning of that, when you're talking about things like leading the way and genetically modifying cows and things like that, the IPCC report gave us 12 years for us to be leaders in that and to, you know, meet that. Do you think it's possible, you know, when you're talking about research versus what's actually happening, paper and practice? Do you think it's maybe just clearing people's conscience about continuing this way?
Yeah, I think that we really need to come to terms with the fact that climate change is the crisis of our time, 100% completely. That is something that really needs to be just realised and meditated upon and just really kind of considered for a bit, because I think when it comes to the IPCC report, that was a damning report. Like, we've never been given such a strong call to action by the scientific community, and they're scientists, you know, they know what's happening more than any politician or person can make up. They're looking at reality.
How much weight was it given in COP? Was it held up quite highly?
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the things that was so distressing about the COP just gone, is that, you know, to get an agreement like you get with the Paris Agreement, it's fantastic that 197 countries signed the Paris Agreement, and then obviously America pulled out, and that has its own implications. But it's a huge commitment to get compromise globally. But I think with compromise comes a weakness of any stance. And when it comes to the IPCC report, there were some countries like the US and like Saudi who were really not keen on it being recognized formally. So the ultimate output of COP24, when it came to solidifying the Paris Agreement rulebook and actually like figuring out what the terms and agreements are, is that the IPCC report was left out of the rulebook, which is tragic and just frankly not good enough. I mean, this is science. We have 12 years to prevent catastrophic effects of climate change. And the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is huge. It's like kind of the difference between 50 million people being hit by climate change or not. And that's by 2050. So, I mean, the stakes are super high. And I think that something like the IPCC report being left out of the agreement at COP24 and the Paris Agreement rulebook is just showing us that while these intergovernmental organizations and institutions are fantastic and it's so important that they exist, they cannot do all of the work for us. You know, we need to be pulling up our socks individually and domestically.
So what do you think it means for the US to pull out of the Paris Agreement, for other countries, as like sort of almost a world leader for a lot of people?
Yeah, the US is one of the largest emitters of carbon emissions, both as a producer and a consumer. So it was huge for them to pull out during COP22 in Marrakesh. But what was really cool that came out of that was the United States pulled out, and then another group was formed that was called the United States People's Delegation, and they have a really strong presence at COP as well, beyond just the official delegates from the White House. So they were formed as a sort of recommitment and saying, you know, Trump might have pulled us out of the Paris Agreement, but as Americans, there's still a lot of people who deeply care about this issue and we are here for the long run.
That's quite amazing.
So it was really amazing, like a really interesting kind of experiment in a government making a decision and then the people going, nah, screw that. We know what we want. We know that things need to be better.
So you've got world leaders pulling out. You've got organizations coming in. Do you think we can leave it up to the UN and pretty much like world-leading governments to meet these sorts of deadlines that the IPCC has kind of outlined?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the IPCC report was incredibly important, as I said, and the United Nations and any intergovernmental institution or organization is incredibly important for that level of operation at the kind of governmental high level part of our society. But that's not where most of the people are, you know. Like, I think that beyond people who are climate deniers, the people who are most dangerous to this whole movement are people who know that something needs to be done differently but choose to live their lives how they would like to, which means not really making as much of an effort as necessary. I mean, climate deniers are are scary, and it's scary to hear them getting a lot of time and attention, but really we've reached like a bit of a critical mass, like enough people, this is scientifically and a kind of well-agreed fact, that enough people know about climate change for us to do exactly what needs to be done. But a lot of people are choosing not to, and we're choosing not to hold our governments and our politicians and our MPs and our businesses and ourselves to account on what we're doing to the planet. And I think that the people who know that there's an issue but choose not to act in a way that is conducive with knowing that there's an issue and for being helpful to the problem are actually more dangerous than climate deniers. So yeah, to answer your question, I think that it's a case of we can't rely on those institutions and our governments to fix the problem. Like, there's a lot of amazing people in civil society who are doing a huge amount of work. I think that's one thing that really came out of COP for me and for the other young people that I went with. It's like the negotiators at the space, who are the ones that get reported on and we see back in our media or whatever, whatever, they're such a small part of the whole COP world. And then beyond the COP world are all the people who aren't at COP or can't make it to COP because they're working in their own communities and can't afford to be there because it's an incredibly exclusive space that's, yeah, very imbalanced in terms of privilege and kind of political dynamics in that sense. So, I mean, there's a group of young people in the US who are suing the US government for harms against their health under climate change and using the laws that are already in place as a kind of backing for that. There was a woman who spearheaded a similar thing in the Netherlands and was actually successful against the government or the state there. In New Zealand, there was a woman called Sarah Thompson who was a law student who did a similar thing against the New Zealand government. It wasn't successful, but there's all these things are going on. Even in New Zealand, there's a woman called India Logan Riley who is at COP pretty much annually and has been for 4 years now. And she's been instrumental in making sure that Indigenous voices are heard at COP. Not only for New Zealand, but for communities around the world that are being harmed still by the effects of colonialism and just a complete lack of care for Indigenous communities. So, I mean, all these things are happening kind of simultaneously. And Lund University in Sweden came out with this research that gave four things that people should be doing in their life to greatly impact climate change and to reduce their emissions. The first was having smaller families or ideally not having children at all. The second was relying more on plant-based diet, and that's backed up by scientists who say that we need to reduce our meat consumption and dairy consumption by 90% in order to be anywhere on line with Paris Agreement commitments. The third one was to stop taking long-haul flights, and the fourth was to not own a car regardless of whether it was electric or petrol or diesel. So there's those four things there that have been backed up by research. I mean, we need to look at ourselves beyond those four points and also think about the privilege that we have as people who are, you know, living in New Zealand. A lot of us have the time, money and circumstances to be doing a lot more for this than we currently are. And 12 years isn't long. I mean, that's just going to go by in a blink of an eye. I mean, New Zealand's going to have 2 meters sea level rise by the end of the century, which is, that takes out a lot of space, takes out a lot of people, and the socio-economic, political impacts of that are ginormous. And so I think we really just need to hold ourselves to account and start mobilizing to hold these international institutions to account also.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
That was indeed The Green Desk. We'll have